result to present on inflation. Okay. So what I decided to do is advertise a language. Going in the microphone.
Yeah, they want to record you.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Tango.
Can you hear me?
I hope so. Okay, so as I was saying, I don't have any new results. What I want to do instead is advertise a language, which I find very convenient. And it's the language that treats adiabatic perturbations as Goldstone bosons of spontaneously broken time translations. Okay? So I developed this in FPH 06, 06, 090 with Creminelli and others, okay? And so what I'm going to do is review the basic formalism. And then if I have time, and hopefully I will review some of its applications, okay? Mostly one for eternal inflation, which I carried out in 07.04.1814, and the systematic application of this to inflation that has been carried out by Creminelli and others when they constructed the effective field theory for inflation. So the basic idea is the following. Suppose we have several matter fields, okay? So we have some matter fields phi A, and we have many of them, okay? And we'd like to understand the dynamics of adiabatic fluctuations in broad generality, okay? So the usual approach would be to write down the most generic matter Lagrangian involving these fields, so which is going to be a function of the fields, their derivatives, higher derivatives, if you want to take into account higher derivative corrections, etc. Okay? Then from the Lagrangian, you would derive the stress energy tensor, okay? And also the equation of motion for the fields. You'd solve the equations of motion for the background, okay, with an FRW ansatz. So let's say I have the solution, let me call them psi bar of t and the FRW metric, g mu of t, okay? Then you perturb expand quantize and derive correlation functions, okay? Now, if you want to do this in complete generality, good luck, right? It's impossible. It's impossible because, in principle, you don't know how many fields you have to begin with. You have infinitely many parameters here, okay? And already solving the equation from background is going to be a nightmare. You cannot do it. Now, what I want to show you is that instead, as long as you focus on adiabatic fluctuations, okay, there is a much simpler way to deal with a generic system, okay? And it's based on the following observation. So suppose this is a field space, okay? So here, let me just plot phi 1 and phi 2, but in general, it's going to be multidimensional. And the classical background trajectory will be some, sorry, the classical background solution will be some trajectory in field space, okay, parameterized by t. So phi a of t. Now, fluctuations will be a generic fluctuation mode will be a generic fluctuation about this trajectory. Okay, so for instance, this trajectory could be running in a valley of a multidimensional potential, okay, or if you have derivative interactions, it could be some more complicated dynamics that selects out this trajectory. Okay? So in particular, transfer to this trajectory, there's going to be, for instance, some potential or something like that. Okay? Now, in general, you cannot say, if you want, you cannot construct in full generality the Lagrangian for generic fluctuations, because this would be as complicated and as arbitrary as the original Lagrangian, okay? But there is one fluctuating mode for which you can say something very general, okay? The fluctuating mode that I'm going to focus on is the longitudinal fluctuation, okay? In general, I can decompose a generic fluctuation into transverse and longitudinal fluctuations, okay? The longitudinal fluctuation, so the fluctuation that happens in the same direction as the classical trajectory, has a chance of being very constrained by the very presence of the classical trajectory, okay? So this, if we forget about gravity, in the usual language of field theory, is exactly the definition of a Goldstone boson, okay? Why the Goldstone boson Lagrangian is very constrained by symmetry? Because the very presence of a solution that spontaneously breaks symmetry tells you that if you perturb the solution exactly in the direction of the symmetry, okay, you have a light mode with interactions constrained by the symmetry you have spontaneously broken, and so on. Okay? Here it's exactly the same. Once again, forgetting for a second about gravity, if I have matter fields, okay, that depend on time, time translations are spontaneously broken, okay? And the longitudinal mode along the classical solution is exactly the Goldstone boson of spontaneously broken time translations. Okay? More precisely, I propose to focus on the following fluctuation. For all A, delta phi of A as a function of space-time is the background solution computed at t plus pi of x minus the background solution itself. So first of all, let notation, okay? In this talk, pi will be different from t 3.14, et cetera, okay? Will be a field. I'm using the letter pi to remind you of pions, okay? Which are the prototype of Goldstone bosons. And also, okay, very good. And also, all order one quantities I'll set to one, okay? So I'll forget about factors of two, etc., of pi. And signs, if they are important, hopefully I will keep track of them. If they're not, they're random, okay? So, okay, so the statement here is that take the background solution, perturb it in the direction of time with a field that is a function of space-time, okay, and subtract the background solution itself, okay? So if you want, at linear order, this is nothing but phi bar dot A times pi, okay? And if you use the same pi for all A's, okay, you are effectively focusing on the tangent fluctuation. Okay? Questions so far? Okay, now, the question is, so far I've done nothing, okay? I've just told you what I want to focus on. Ah, by the way, I claim that these are exactly adiabatic perturbations, according to the usual nomenclature. These are exactly adiabatic perturbations because adiabatic perturbations have the property that locally they are just a time translation of the unperturbed background, okay? So you are effectively perturbing all matter fields in a synchronized way, okay? Such that locally what you have is indistinguishable, if you have a very long wavelength mode, say, locally what you have is indistinguishable from the background. It's just the background time translation. Now, of course, if I introduce gravity, okay, you have to say something about what I do for G mu nu. Now, there's going to be one trivial mode in which I also do this gauge transformation on GMU, okay? So that's nothing, that's just gauge mode, okay? So let me say that first you gauge fix GMU. GMU, let's say you use Newtonian gauge or something, or zeta gauge. No, actually zeta gauge, some other gauge. And then you perform this shift, okay? Otherwise, there is a gauge ambiguity. Okay, now the question is, can we... No, let me gauge fix the metric first, okay? Let's say I fix Newtonian gauge, okay? And so I say the metric is in Newtonian gauge and on the metric field. I'll be more precise afterwards, okay? I want just to say that you have to be careful about what you do to the metric, right? Because otherwise you might be concentrating on a gauge mode, which is nothing. Okay, so the question now is, can we write down an effective Lagrangian, the most generic effective Lagrangian, independently of the original Lagrangian we started with? We don't even want to talk about this, because this is completely arbitrary, okay? It has infinitely many parameters, so we don't even want to talk about it. So, first observation is that with this approach, we are giving up the attempt to find an inflationary background, okay? So this is not a model for inflation in the sense that it's not a nice model that gives you an inflationary background with such an input, et cetera, et cetera, okay? This is just the observation that whatever A of T you give me, okay, whatever A of T you want to reproduce, I can cook up a Lagrangian that has A of T as a background solution, okay? And so, since this is not very constraining, let me start from whatever A of T you want, and let me construct instead the most generic effective Lagrangian for perturbation, okay? And let me try to see if this is constrained to some extent, okay? So that I can make model independent statements, okay? And it will turn out that the effective Lagrangian for adiabatic fluctuations for that particular mode is very constraining, okay? And it will allow us to make very generic predictions. So, the other remark I want to make is that when you have a gauge theory, the Goldstone boson of the spontaneously broken gauge symmetry is not really a propagating mode, right? You know that you can go to a gauge in which you can set it to zero, okay, and all the degrees of freedom are in the metric. And that's somehow the physical gauge, whatever that means. So here too, you can decide to pick a gauge in which pi is equal to zero, okay? That is to say, in which the metric fields take their background value. For that particular fluctuation, there always is such a gauge, okay? Because I'm choosing the same pi for all metric fields. So picking this, if I start from that gauge, picking this gauge is equivalent to translated time into pi minus pi, okay? So in this gauge, pi is not there, and the scalar mode is in the metric, okay? For instance, this is zeta gauge, right? Where zeta parameterizes the scalar fluctuations and the metric fields are unperturbed. Okay, so the question now is, given A of T, how do we construct the most generic Lagrangian for adiabatic fluctuations? So first step, choose this gauge. Okay, because it's much more convenient to work directly in this gauge. By definition of our fluctuations, we can always do it. The second observation is that you have some residual symmetries, okay? In particular, the background solution spontaneously breaks time translations. Your gauge manifestly breaks time diffeomorphisms in the sense that you already totally fix the time diffeomorphisms by choosing pi not to be there, pi to be equal to zero, okay? So what you're left with is spatial diffs. Under which x shifts by a function of t and x. Okay? Yes? Why do you say there's topology? Ah. Yes, I don't know really. But I mean, I'm choosing unitary gauge to construct the Lagrange. And then, of course, for instance, we never computed loop corrections in this formalism. But if you want to compute loop corrections, you can choose any other gauge. But just to construct the Lagrange, I'm saying use unitary gauge. Yeah, what I'm saying is that I don't know here because I never computed loops here, but what I'm saying is that if now you want to compute loops, choose another gauge. Once you have the Lagrangian, please transform it to any other gauge you like.
Assuming that this constant phi surfaces are space-like.
Well, if you're not eternally inflating, you can do it. Right?
Yeah, so there would be situations where this is not.
Yes, but this is nothing but integrate, right? So
sure.
Also, the usual computations integrate levels. Yeah, but I agree. You're right. You're assuming that you can choose such a gauge.
It is like you're putting a cutoff in the U because at some point, by assuming it's a space, like you mean phi that is smaller than the gradient.
Sorry, you're assuming that d mu phi a is a space-like vector, is a time-like vector. Sorry, right? So as you're saying, if you go to short enough distances, you will have crazy quantum fluctuations. So at some point, this breaks down. But so does the usual zeta computation, right? So The assumption is that if you want, it doesn't break down at Hubble, okay, but it breaks down parametrically inside Hubble. And that's equivalent to stating that you're not in eternal inflation. That's equivalent. Okay, so I have these residual symmetries. And in the sense that both the background solution and our gauge choice are invariant under this symmetry. Okay. Also, the fact that the background solution continuously breaks time translations tells you that the Lagrangian for fluctuations will have explicit functions of time in. Okay. So time translations are broken, so they're not a symmetry anymore. Functions of time are allowed by the residual symmetries. Okay? From the top-down viewpoint, that is to say, if you imagine to start from here, find the solution, and then factor, the fact that you have phi of a as a function of time tells you that if the original Lagrangian depend on phi of a, etc., okay, now when I compute it in unitary gauge, this will be phi of a of t, etc. Okay, and here I have an explicit function of time from the viewpoint of fluctuations. Okay, because the fluctuations know nothing about the original phis, they only see the background. The background explicitly depends on time. So fluctuations will have a Lagrangian that explicitly depends on time. And okay, so the statement is that actually, I could use these technological devices, etc. Okay. So the statement is that the most generic action for adiabatic fluctuations, let me call it SM, in the sense that it's going to be the Lagrangian for matter. Okay. So Lagrangian for gravity is always going to be square root of g d4 x r.
times appropriate powers of G. Okay? The Lagrangian for matter, I want to rewrite it in this formalism. Okay? And I want to rewrite this formalism according to this prescription. That is to say, it has to be a Lagrangian that is invariant under special diffeomorphisms and that contains explicit functions of time, because time translations are broken spontaneously. Okay? So SM should be the most generic S of the metric variables, okay? Because now, in this gauge, I have no matter variables. Matter variables are trivial, so the only fluctuating degrees of freedom are in the metric.
Okay, so the metric Lagrangian is going to be a function just of the metric, in this particular case. And invariant. Under special diffeomorphism.
When you write the first one, do you mean perturbed?
Exactly. So I'm rewriting, if you want, I'm writing the total action, okay, including that for the background, because as you will see, imposing the cancellation of tuples, imposing the cancellation of linear terms in the fluctuations, will give us a non-trivial constraint. So let me write in this particular gauge the total action, okay, including the action for the background. And it's particularly doable in this gauge because everything depends just on the metric. Okay, so I don't have to worry about all the complicated structure I might have here. Okay? And you see that there is a nice derivative expansion which involves only the metric variables. Okay, so the other observation is that given the residual symmetry, it's particularly convenient to use AVM variables, right? Okay, in AVM variables, splitting between time and space is very explicit. Okay? And it's a nice splitting that keeps manifest invariance under special diffeomorphisms. It is to say, you want to use these objects now to construct nice covariant objects to transform as tensors under special diffeomorphisms. Okay? So the nice covariant objects are the following. N, from the point of view of special diffeomorphisms, is a scalar. And I is not a vector, because it then gets some shift, okay? But Gij, of course, is a metric tensor, so it transforms as usual under gauge transformations. But out of Gij and Ni, we can construct a nice tensor, which is the extrinsic curvature. So this is the extrinsic curvature of space-like hypersurfaces, that is to say, of equal time surfaces. Okay, and this is a tensor. From Gij, you can construct the three-dimensional intrinsic curvature of, let's say, Ij. Of equal time surfaces, and this is also a tensor, and so on. Okay, you keep going. Exactly like you do in GR. Here you want to do it explicitly, separately for time indices and space indices. Okay. Now, as usual in an effective theory, you want now to have a derivative expansion. Okay, because in general, the theory you are going to have is an ordinary bicycle theory, and so you can use a finite set of operators if you are below some cutoff scale. Okay, and the way you do it, you do this is write down all the operators consistent with the symmetries in a derivative expansion. Okay, and the lowest the number of derivatives, the most important, these operators are going to be at low range with respect to the cutoff. Okay, so in this gauge, in which everything depends only on the metric, of course, this is a zero derivative object. This is a one derivative object. This is a two derivative object. And so on. Okay? So I want to use these nice covariant things to construct the most generic metal action and the derivative expansion. Questions?
You're gonna make this local probably when you write the action down.
Sorry?
I imagine you're gonna look at the only local operators.
So yes.
Is that an assumption? Supposing I had started from scratch and I was calculating from wanted to predict the adiabatic perturbations and I had also, isocurvature perturbations, and I integrate them out.
Yes. Okay. Very good.
Including that.
So we never extended the formalism to include isocurvature fluctuations, and I agree with you that either you integrate them out and so you parameterize their effect as no local operators, or you keep them explicitly.
Uh-huh.
We never did that.
But this is kind of where you're meeting that assumption at some point, you make it local.
Yes, exactly. Here, if you want, here I'm focusing exclusively on the dynamics of the adiabatic perturbations, neglecting isocurvature perturbations. And the reason I do so is that isocurvature perturbations, by definition, are very model dependent.
Right.
Whereas the dynamics of this model is going to be very model independent, in the sense that different models in the derivative expansion we differ just by a finite number of parameters, like 2, 3, something like this, right? Whereas if you start including isocurvature perturbations, you basically have infinite free. Okay, so that's the downside, of course. But it's not the downside with respect to the original formulation, right?
Right?
If you want isocurvature fluctuations, restore the infinite freedom you have in the original formulation. Whereas if you stick to the adiabatic ones, you are very constrained.
But there is the assumptions that you have a very slightly broken time symmetry, right?
So far, A of T is totally generic, okay? And then, if you want, once you focus on inflationary backgrounds, you have some additional approximate shift symmetry. But let me stress that so far this is totally generic. I can use it for any A of T. Okay, this is going to be an effective Lagrangian for adiabatic perturbations about any theory. Okay, so the zero derivative Lagrangian, since the only zero derivative object we can use, which is a scalar under our symmetries, is n, okay, or g00, they are the same. Okay, the zero derivative Lagrangian is going to be a generic function of G00. Now here, let me stress one thing. So here I'm using the four-dimensional square root of G. I could as well use the natural integration measure, which is now given our symmetry G3, okay, the three-dimensional thing. But the two differ just by a function of G00 with a parenthesis, or n, if you want. Since n is a scalar, I can choose to use this or this interchangeably because the difference I can reabsorb into F. Okay? So the difference between the two measures is a scalar, so you choose whichever you like. So I find it more convenient to use the four dimensional G. And as we said, the gravitational action is nothing but the usual one. Now, the background, you see that now, since in this gauge there's no reference to the metal fields, it's enough to specify A of T to specify the background. I don't need to specify phi A of T. That's the advantage of this, okay? You are totally insensitive to how you parameterize your metal fields, etc., etc. Phi A of T do not even appear. It's enough to specify A of T. In particular, for the background, G00 is minus 1. Okay, it's an F under the background. And as I said, it's convenient that we have written the total actions, which is to say not only the action for perturbations, but the action including the action for the background, because now we can use the background equation of motion. The background equation of motion is very simple in this formalism, because T mu nu, by definition, is the derivative of the matter action with respect to G mu nu. The matter action depends exclusively on G mu nu. Okay? So I take this derivative. It's going to involve F and derivatives of F. Okay? I impose that the background solves Einstein's equations for my given A of T. So I'm considering that A of T is given once for all. Okay? And this imposes a cancellation of tadpoles, if you want. It imposes that linear objects here in fluctuations are going to cancel with these linear objects here. Okay? And this gives us a nice constraint. It tells us,
you mean with the full matter action, not just the third derivative one, right?
Very good. Good point. It turns out that if I include the higher derivative for actions to the matter action, I can rewrite the tadpoles, that is to say the terms that contribute to the background equations of motion, I can rewrite them as higher order, by integration by parts, as higher order terms. That is to say, since these involve derivatives, and I'm looking at linear things, okay, linear things are always of the form some covariant derivative acting on something, okay, which is trivial, okay, and so you're left with the second order and higher terms. So it turns out that the tadpoles are only the ones, if you want, you can use a parameterization which the only tadpoles that there are the only the ones appearing in the zero derivative. Yeah, that's a good point, thank you. That's a good point because, as we see, this simplifies, and so. Okay, so the cancellation of tadpoles, that is to say the background equation of motion, imposes that f of g00, and let me make explicit the fact that, as we said, it will depend explicitly on time, because time position is broken, is the following. Times the operator 1, let me say trivial, okay, trivial operator, this is like cosmological constant, as we will see, the potential more properly, plus 1 over n pi g, h dot, times g zero zero. Okay? So you should think of this plus higher orders in delta g zero zero, where delta g zero zero is by definition g zero zero minus its background. Okay? So plus 1. Higher order in g zero zero. So you should interpret this expression in the following sense. The dynamical variable is g00, okay? G mu nu in general. And these are coefficients, let me call it C of t, let's say this, let me call it lambda of t. These are coefficients that explicitly depend on time, okay? And the statement I'm making is that the background equations of motion constrains these two coefficients, whereas they leave totally arbitrary the higher order terms, okay? And that's very sensible because the background equation of motion has to do with the linear variation of the action, okay? So they cannot tell you anything about quadratic terms, okay? But it's important that these two terms are constrained, as we will see in a second. Now, and so the higher order terms there, as I said, are totally arbitrary, and so if I expand in fluctuations, I can parameterize them with three coefficients that explicitly depend on time. And these coefficients are totally arbitrary. And when I say totally arbitrary, I mean that from this viewpoint, from the viewpoint of the effective Lagrangian for adiabatic perturbations, there's no constraints on them. Okay? And it also means, you can show, that if you want to be convinced, you can hook up a Lagrangian for metal fields that has exactly this expansion when you expand around the background, okay, with any given m of t. Okay?
So what happened to delta G I J?
Okay, so far, well, first of all, you see, we have a delta G I J in the metric, sorry, in the integration measure there. Okay, so
yeah.
If there, and at this order, it's the only thing, it's the only place where it can be, right? Because you have to be covariant under special diffeomorphisms. At the zero derivative level, GH, the only covariant thing you can write down for GH is square root of G. That's it. Okay, only when we go to higher orders in derivatives, we will have extra appearances of GIJ. But at this order, We only have G00 in the generic expression like this, and the G, the square root of GIJ in the mesh. Okay? Now, so following Eugene's example, is he crazy? So am I crazy? what is this crap? So let me give you an example.
You guys are relying on Hinchcliffe's theorem, right? That if there's a question mark in the title, the answer's out of the
So let me give you the simplest possible example to show you that this makes a lot of sense. So, example, consider a minimally coupled scalar with a potential, okay? Consider Slowron inflation, for instance. So you have that the matter field, sorry, the matter action is something like minus one half, G mu, G mu phi, G mu phi. I'm writing explicitly the powers of G mu nu, okay? Because eventually our variables are G mu nu and nothing else. Plus V of phi times the root of G before x, okay? Now, you solve the equations of motion, so you get some phi of t and some a of t. Okay? How is your term? I use unitary gauge. Unitary gauge, as we said, is equivalent to choosing phi to be unperturbed. That is to say, that the full phi is nothing but the ground phi. Okay? Plug back into the action this gauge choice. From here, what you get is exactly minus one half phi bar dot square times G00 with upper indices. From here, what you get is V evaluated on phi bar of T. Now, if you use the Friedman equations for the background, you will discover that this is exactly 1 over 8 pi gh dot, okay? And the potential term is exactly this, okay? So the advantage of this formalism, if you want, is that you free yourself from using the background solutions for the scalars, and you're able to re-express these two coefficients in terms of the background for the metric. Okay, so you don't need to know the solution for the scalar. So you see that this particular example is exactly of that form with the choice of the higher derivative of the higher order terms in delta G00 being set to zero. Okay? Because we only have the first two terms, the ones that are imposed by the tarball constellations. Okay? If you want to go further and you, let's say you have a more generic Lagrangian, which is a function of phi and x, where x is usually d phi squared. Okay? You can do the same, okay, now you know how to do it. Basically, what you have to do is rewrite this on its background solution. And what you get in unitary gauge is t computed at phi bar of t, and x is nothing but g00 phi bar dot square of t. Okay? And now, you, if you expand in fluctuations of g00, of course, you will have an expansion like this, where these coefficients are fixed by derivatives of p, and their time dependence has to do with the fact that phi bar and phi bar dot are functions of p.
How about a spatial derivative of delta G naught?
Sorry?
A spatial derivative of delta G naught.
Very good. So you want to use covariant objects, okay? So, and the way, the convenient way to construct variable objects is think in terms of ideal variables, okay, which transform nicely under special diffeomorphisms. And you know that the first covariant object with special for time derivatives, you can write is the extrinsic curvature, which does not involve, for instance, special derivatives of G00.
Okay.
Okay?
So if I have to do DBI, for example,
yes.
How many terms are, how high order I have to keep?
Very good. So the point is that, so from the point of view of finding the background evolution, you want to keep the full function, full square root of G, the full square root, etc., etc. Now, from the point of view of studying the dynamics of fluctuations, it's up to you. So you want to compute the spectrum, then you should stop at second order. You want to compute the three-point function, then stop at cubic order, and so on. Okay? So if you want, this is a thanks for asking. So this is a nice way in which, from the point of view of studying fluctuations, this is a more convenient language, because it focuses directly on a perturbative expansion about the solution. And so if you want to compute the correlation functions for fluctuations, that's what you want to do. Okay? You don't want to go through the whole machinery of finding the solution and then perturb it. Okay? This is explicitly, from the get-go, a perturbative expansion about the solution.
Sorry.
Okay?
Just ask, I didn't understand the response to Nash's question, because what's wrong with, say, del squared n functions?
Sorry?
What's wrong with functions of the Laplacian on n, but that's things like that?
Laplacian on n?
Because you said he was asking, what about spatial derivatives? So
yes.
So 0, I presume.
Okay, so that's a two-derivative object.
Yeah.
Okay? And of course you have to covariantize it with respect to G and J.
Yeah.
That's fine. It will appear at the two-derivative level.
It will appear, okay. So you're going to include that one.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But what I'm saying is that, as usual, you want to start, by the way, from the point of view of the Goldstone, that it corresponds to three derivatives acting on the Goldstone, as you will see in a second. So you want to start with the lowest number of derivatives, okay? And you know, by construction, that terms with higher number of derivatives are going to be less important at low energies. So you want to start from the bottom up, okay?
So then I ask you something very stupid. But so, what should I do with the first part of the action, which is linear in G00? So,
okay, very good. So, okay, the good point. So, it's linear in G00. It's not linear in delta G00, in the sense that, if you want, what am I saying? No, you're right. You shouldn't do anything, in the sense that it's auto, by choosing this coefficient to be exactly this, that part is going to be automatically cancelled by linear terms in the gradation action. But they want to keep it, because when we, once we reintroduce pi, we will get a nice constraint coming from it. Okay?
Can I ask
so, if, yes?
I'm a little confused. So it seems to me you're saying you can write a Lagrangian if you have all these functional signs, like lambda of t, m of t, and so on. Right? Yeah, so somebody gives us all these
functional
times, and then if I write a Lagrangian,
is
okay.
Yes, and if you want, what I'm saying is that.
But then it means that I have to come up with another Lagrangian that gives me the dynamics for all these.
No, what I'm saying is that from this viewpoint, it's clear that these are totally arbitrary. Okay, so you cannot hope if your predictions are relying, for instance, on the time dependence of these constants, etc., they are model dependent. So these coefficients are going to be model dependent, and if you want, they correspond to possible original Lagrangians you can come up with. Okay? And it's clear from this point of view that you have to make some assumptions, for instance, some symmetry assumptions. For instance, in inflation, as we will see in a second, since in inflation h dot and h double dot are almost constant apart from slower corrections, okay, you can assume, it's consistent to assume, but probably you don't have to, but it's consistent to assume that the same approximate shift symmetry is shared by these constants, okay? And so from that point of view, at lowest order is low roll, you can take these parameters as being constant, okay? And these are arbitrary, so these parameterize, if you want, even if they are constant, they are arbitrary. So these parameterize different models of inflation, okay? And what I'm saying is that it's, of course, as arbitrary as the original Lagrangian, but this parametrization is better suited to studying the dynamics of fluctuations, because at any order in fluctuations, you only have a finite number of parameters, okay? Whereas here, if you start from the Lagrangian expanded about phi equals 0, let's say. and you find a solution which perhaps relies on infinitely many terms, for instance, like in DBI, which you have to use a full square root structure to find the solution, okay? Then the dynamics for, if you want, from this point of view, different modes of inflation will differ by infinitely many parameters. Whereas here, at any finer order in perturbations, okay, different models of inflation differ only by a finite number of parameters.
Yeah, so at this level, so I think like we have gone from having the, from our spectrum where we had epsilon, eta, h, this function of time. Now you're translating them back into m of t, m theta of t, lambda of t. But in the end, the hope is that if you come up with a fundamental theory that relates those to something like.
No, of course, yeah. What I'm saying here is that I give up the problem of finding the ground solution, okay? Because I can hook up a Lagrangian that I can hook up a Lagrangian that reproduces any background E of T I want, okay? And so I want to parameterize instead of dynamics of fluctuations in a more efficient way. But I agree with you that as long as I don't have fundamental theory, I don't know what these parameters are. But for instance, I can use now standard effective field intuition, which is to say, probably all these parameters are going to be on the same order, because if you want the system to be stable under radiative corrections, you don't want, you basically, as usual in effective theory, you want to be, you want all dimensionful parameters to be of the order of the cutoff, something like this. Okay? And perhaps more.
Sorry, I missed something. Why? What? You keep saying this initial Lagrangian has an infinite number of parameters, and there's some examples.
Yeah.
Going to this early Lagrangian. Why isn't there a power counting in this initial Lagrangian?
Yeah, because the point is that you can, let's say you, for instance, Weinberg's viewpoint is exactly that, right? Weinberg's effective theory of inflation is saying, okay, let me construct a Wozzenary effective Lagrangian for the inflaton,
yeah.
And expand in derivatives. And that's fine. But the point is that there are situations, like DBI, for instance, in which the solution relies on infinitely many operators when you expand the Lagrangian about phi equals 0. That is to say, the expansion about phi equals 0 could have nothing to do with the expansion about the inflationary solution. The inflationary solution could even be, I don't know, some strongly coupled condensate or something like this. Okay? So, the perturbative expansion you have here about phi equals 0, when you construct the Lagrangian, let's say, about Minkowski space, in principle, it has nothing to do with the perturbative expansion about the inflating solution.
Except that your strong coupling limit is the same. I mean, like, you end up with a result from the strong coupling limit, PDI is the same. You can't have any other Lagrangian, right? So you still can't pass that.
No, of course you cannot pass that. But what I'm saying is that, in a sense, this is more general in the sense that you can talk about perturbative excitation, even if the background solution arises by some strong coupling dynamics, something like this. For instance, in the ghost condensate, the scalar picture in terms of phi and x is a cartoon, okay? So it's varied at the classical level, okay? But it has no quantum mechanical sense, in the sense that phi equals zero does not correspond to any sensible vacuum state. Okay, so if you want, in the ghost condensate, this is the only sensible way of approaching the system. Is to say, once I have the condensate, let me write the effective Lagrangian about the condensate. Okay, because the condensate could be very strongly coupled from the point of view of the Minkowski version. Okay, but at the classical, first of all, let me stress this. At the classical level, these two parameterizations are perfectly equivalent, okay? What I'm saying is that perhaps this is more sensible from the quantum viewpoint, first of all, because you have directly a perturbative expansion in terms of the background you're interested in, and also because sometimes the background you're interested in could arise from some crazy quantum.
So arguably it's more convenient, but there's perfectly good examples of other effective field theories that have infinite powers of operators. Our QCD and arguably SCT, and those are perfectly fine effective field theories. There's nothing wrong with formulating it that way. It might be more convenient for you to formulate things this way, but there's other effective field theories that have infinite towers of operators, and it's not really an issue.
Now, I'm not saying that it's an issue to have infinitely many operators. I'm saying that it could be, like in DBI, that the background solution you're interested in, the inflationary background, relies on the infinite number of operators, okay? And so what I'm saying is that it relies on knowing infinitely many coefficients, okay? Even though, eventually, when we want to compute correlation functions for perturbations, we're interested in two-point functions, three-point functions, etc. So what I'm saying is that it's more convenient to have directly a parametrization in terms of the finite number of parameters, instead of using infinitely many parameters here to find a solution, expand for perturbations about the solution, and then keep only a finite number of terms in the perturbation Lagrange.
I mean, this is just a reorganization of what you had in the original Lagrange.
It's just a reorganization, okay? It's just
a reorganization.
I'm saying, if I have a function and I'm interested in the fluctuations about the point, let me expand directly about the point, okay? Without even mentioning what the function looks like away from that point. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying it's more convenient, and sometimes I'm saying it could be the only sensible way of doing so, because the solution could arise from some strongly double dynamics in terms of
more convenient I'll buy, but I don't know if it's here. Well,
you have to give me an example to convince me.
DBI is
like that. DBI we can do perfectly fine.
I mean,
without having to do this. I can see the nice thing about this is that you're treating both the scalar perturbation and presumably the tensor perturbation uniformly, in a sense, operating metric.
Yeah.
So I can see advantage to that. But more like a uniformity or convenience. I don't see there's any case, you have to give me an example, that you can find a perturbation from this way, but not the other way. They're equivalent, so I don't see any.
No, they're equivalent,
any example that I cannot do the other way, but you can do your way. So then I would be convinced.
It's just quick. It's
a finite number of terms this way, and of course, in DBI, it's an infinite number, but happily you know how to resum them.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
In principle, you had an infinite number that you didn't know how to resum.
No, but
what is it?
The finite, you have to tell me what n looks like. N's complicated then, I can tell you for sure.
But for the fluctuations, you know, you don't so much care.
But for instance, for ghost inflation, the theory of ghost inflation about phi equals zero is a joke, okay? So it's a classical Lagrangian, but you don't believe it quantum mechanical. So why even mention it if instead you're interested in the dynamics of perturbation about a completely different point? Just go around that point. That's what I'm saying. And sometimes I'm saying the inflationary background is not under control from this point of view. For instance, in ghost inflation, if you want, the existence of inflationary background is an assumption in a sense, because it doesn't arise from a relativistic Lagrangian that you write down about Minkowski space. Okay? But even if you don't believe this, I'm saying it's just a more convenient way of parametric fluctuations because you focus directly on fluctuations. So you have, from the get-go, a finite number of operators. Okay?
Can I ask a different question?
So yes.
You know?
Only it's different.
So you know for the P of X things, the square root form is special to, you know, the nonlinear realized symmetry. You know, for P of X models, the DBI-like form is special because it's non-linearly realized symmetry, so that's why it's protected. So how can you see that in this language?
Hmm. Yeah, good point. So you're saying it should be like a relation between all these
different functions. Yeah, some functions MFT must be special because they're more protected against misdirection.
Good point. Yeah, I didn't say. You're right. Yeah, there's a way, there should be a way of assuming this. And yeah, there should be a relation between, as you're saying, between time dependencies and a relation between.
But I guess you calculate the tadpole correction, so that was something like that, right?
Not sure. Why the tadpole corrections? I would say, for instance, these terms should arise from expanding the famous square root, right? So there's going to be, first of all, relations between all these different terms. And somehow, there's going to be a very special choice, as you're saying, is going to have
Can you also see it from the idea that the magnitude of the magnetism is larger, right? Because if you get something where it weren't right, like if there wasn't a special case, you get some up. So if you get it large.
No, but let me get to that. Why do you say all the one? No, because exactly, because the point is that you see, the here I'm explicitly constructing a perturbative theory for fluctuations, okay? And
but that's the thing. If you had started with a Q max and high, where you only could do an expansion, and you didn't have some special symmetry that allowed you to sum it up, you would have gotten a couple more.
No, no, exactly. Okay. Why do you say so?
If I can expand square root.
No, in fact, why do you want to expand square root? You
know,
sort of physics.
I'm just saying, in answer to Andrew's question,
right.
Yes. One of the ways that you could see that there's special physics that allows you to have much more, you don't, for example, expand
right,
square root. You
right.
know how to sum it up.
Right.
That's when you get orange FNL. So here you're also going to get orange FNL
right.
in cases.
In fact, expanding it would be very bad.
But not necessarily outside the perturbative regime.
No, of course. Ah,
okay.
What I'm saying is a huge range between.
Yes.
Ah,
okay.
Right.
Yes, okay. Okay, I agree with you, but perturbations are still going to be within
the capital.
Of course.
Bigger than one.
Okay, anyway, so in the last 30 seconds, let me go the last 20 pages of my talk. So, okay, so the unitary gauge Lagrangian is all we need to compute correlation functions. Because, for instance, many times when we want to compute correlation function for zeta, we exactly go to unitary gauge. Right? So once you have the Lagrangian, you should just express it in terms of zeta, solve the constraint equations, plug it back into the Lagrangian, you have the Lagrangian for zeta, and then you compute to quantize, and then you compute correlation functions. But to see some properties of this Lagrangian, it's more convenient to reintroduce the Gauss component, okay, to introduce pi. Now, as I said, pi is not a dynamical degree of freedom, it's eaten by the metric, blah, 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 still. As for massive gauge theories, it's a very convenient parametrization of the dynamics at short distances. Okay? When you go at distances in a massive gauge theory, when you go at distances parametrically shorter than the quantum wavelength, okay, the Gostron boson, the would-be Gostron boson of broken gauge symmetry, is the most interacting degree of freedom. Okay? So it's a convenient parametrization of the most relevant dynamics you have at short distances. Here is the same. At sub-horizon scales, pi is the scalar mode, pi is a very convenient parameterization of the dynamics. So let me, by the way, the Hubble scale here plays the role of the mass of the gravity. Okay, so in this gauge, massive gauge theory example, the role of the mass of the gauge boson is played by the Hubble scale. Okay, Hubble scale sets the scale at which the mixing between scalar fluctuations and the metric become of order one importance, okay? But if I go at very short distances, I can neglect gravity, okay? And the dynamics is well captured by pi. So let me reproduce pi by undoing, I don't have it here, by undoing the gauge transformation I did to go to unitary gauge, okay? So let me reproduce it. So at this level, we are only interested in what G00 does. 0,0 under a gauge transformation like this, let's do this, plus mu pi squared, plus things that are surprised by delta G00. Okay? Here the logic is the following. As I said, at very short distances, I only want to focus on pi and forget about gravity. Okay? So what I'm going to do is reintroduce pi by undoing the gauge transformation I did to go to unitary gauge, okay, and set to zero all metric fluctuations, okay? Because, as I said, at short distances, mixing with metric fluctuations should not matter, okay? So keep only pi in the Lagrangian. What you get is the following. The Lagrangian, the metal Lagrangian. So, first of all, the gravitational Lagrangian gives you nothing. It gives you nothing in terms of pi, because the gravitational Lagrangian is the usual one, which is invariant under the full four-dimensional diffeomorphisms, okay? And so I'm just doing a time redefinition. So the gravitational Lagrangian can do nothing in terms of pi. The meta-Lagrangian instead, which is a function of G00, when I do this, gives me what? So there is V3x, sorry, d4x, a cube of t, about the background coming from the square root of g. And then you have, sorry, 4 and 4 from the 4th minus n plus square, h dot by n square, plus n plus square, h dot, radical of pi square, plus n to the 4, pi dot, n pi square, etc. So where are these terms coming from? Well, the quadratic terms are coming from, so from here I get nothing, okay? Because I don't have g0, okay? From here, by the way, the measure I'm using is square root of four dimensional g, which is the right one to be invariant under the full invariance, so I don't get anything from the measure, okay? So from here I don't get anything, okay? From here, given the transformation law of g0, which is somewhere here, I get the linear term. The linear term is a total derivative, and if you do things properly with the metric fluctuation, it cancels by construction, okay? And I get quadratic terms, okay? I also get quadratic terms from here, in particular from the first operator here, delta g0 squared, because delta g0 has a pi dot in the transformation, and so I get pi dot squared from here. That's why pi dot squared has two contributions. One is proportional to n4, and the other is proportional to h dot. Okay? Whereas the gradient of pi squared only comes from here, okay? Because the way it would appear here is at least a cubic order. And indeed, from here, from this operator, I also get interactions. When in delta g0, I pick pi dot, and on the other delta g0, I pick gradient of pi square, okay, I get the interaction I display, and so on.
You also have a pi dot cube term, right?
Yes, yes. I have many, many terms. Yes, exactly. I have a pi dot cube. Now, how much do I have? Like,
basically, how much you need?
Okay, let me 5 minutes. Let me give you just one application to show you why this should be relevant. So, well, the first application, of course, is the first next thing is a relation between different operators in terms of pi. Okay, so for instance, the same operator delta g0 squared contributes both to the kinetic term of pi and to interactions, okay? Which means that, for instance, if I take a limit in which this is very large, much larger than this, okay? This limit will correspond to a small speed of sound, as we will now see, and that small speed of sound will also increase the interactions of pi, that is to say the non-Gaussian speed, okay? So this, if you want, from the viewpoint of this formalism, it's nice to see that there are non-trivial consistency relations, in a sense, between different observables that just come from symmetry, okay? The same operators in unitary gauge contribute to different orders in pi, okay? Now, why do I say that a large n to the fourth gives you a small speed of sound? Well, because if I take the limit n to the fourth much larger than n plus square h dot, I have n to the fourth pi dot square minus plus n plus square h dot gradient of pi square. Okay? And the ratio between these two guys is the speed of sound. Okay, it gives you the dispersion relation for small pi fluctuations. Actually we should call it the speed of pi if you want, okay? But for some reason, it's called the speed of sound. So, the speed of sound square is nothing but minus n prime square h dot over n to the fourth. Okay? So, what I'm saying is that if the speed of sound is much smaller than 1, it means that n to the fourth is very large, okay? Which means that interactions are very large, okay? Which means that you have a Gaussian signal which is very large. Now, as the only application, I have many applications here, but as the only application of this, let me just notice the following. You see that here the gradient energy of pi has no freedom, okay? Is totally fixed by the background solution, okay? And is proportional to H dot. Okay? Whereas the kinetic term, the pi dot square, has some freedom. In particular, we have three parameters, which means that in the original Lagrangian language, you can come up with a Lagrangian that gives you anything you want here, okay? The gradient of pi square term has no freedom, okay? And in particular, if you violate the null energy condition, if the background violates the null energy condition, and to say if h dot is larger than zero, this has the wrong sign, okay? Which means that the system is unstable, okay? It means that it has a negative gradient energy. So if you want, for this viewpoint, it's very nice that what's problematic about coming up with a sensible null energy condition violating cosmology is forced upon us by symmetry considerations, okay, and is the fact that adiabatic perturbations might be unstable. I say might because so far we have neglected higher periodic corrections, okay, and I'm not going to talk about them, of course. And it turns out that there is a regime in which higher derivative correlation can fix the problem, okay? But at least from this point of view, it's very clear why the problem is there, okay? And having a nice perturbative expansion and a derivative expansion allows you also to come up with possible solutions that you can trust perturbatively, and you can check the stability, relative stability of, etc. Okay? Whereas, if you start from the derivative Lagrangian, it's very cumbersome how to, first of all, it's not very cumbersome to see the problem, but it may be very cumbersome to try to solve it, okay? Because you don't know really how to fix it, because you don't know how to modify the original Lagrangian in terms of the matter fields in such a way that once you go above the background, the fluctuations are very big. Okay, so I guess I'll stop here. Thank you.
Is m to the fourth positive always?
Yes, you want it to be positive. You want it to be positive because otherwise, so the speed of sound here is something like this. If you don't assume it to be very large, okay? And then you want the speed of sound to be smaller than one, probably, in the sense that unless you're willing to have superluminal excitations, which perhaps, I mean, I'm not claiming they are necessarily consistent, but for sure they don't have a nice standard relativistic incompletion. Okay, so unless you're willing to do that, you want M4 to be positive in order for the denominator to be smaller than the numerator. Yeah, there's a number of fake signs here, so you take the absolute value of each dot.
When the theory for the perturbation does have to be weakly coupled?
But it does not, indeed.
What is the theory for the perturbation?
So, if it is strongly coupled, you don't pass it in the ground, right? I'd say. So.
You're saying that there is direct integration?
Well, I'm saying that. I would say so, although, I mean, I have no proof, but I'd say that. It means that you get large correction, that you can expect large corrections to the ground solution, no?
That was a solution. So you took into account the corrections and you expanded
around the screen. Yeah, but if the expansion is not very well defined, it's not clear. Anyway, so another nice thing is that from here you can see directly, I'm not going to show you, but you can see directly that if the speed of sound is much smaller than one, okay, before reaching the eternal inflation regime, which corresponds to zeta over 1, you reach a strongly coupled regime. Okay, it is to say, when the speed of sound is much smaller than 1, you can check the typical amplitude of fluctuations and the typical amplitude of interactions. As we said, interactions are enhanced by a small speed of sound. Okay, and you can check that the theory of fluctuations becomes strongly coupled at h before reaching the eternal inflation regime. Okay. Yes, I have no proof that if fluctuations are strongly coupled, the Bayesian solution you are postulating is not a solution, but of course you also have no proof otherwise.
On that note, we should.